Hey, does your doctor know how much money you make? Because they probably should. You've no doubt heard about studies that link poverty to poor health. And even if you hadn't, it should make sense to you, instinctively, that the two might be related. So if that's the case, why don't we treat poverty as the medical issue that it clearly is? Today, we'll meet a doctor who is trying to change that by raising awareness, of course, and by involving himself in policy discussions and academic work, but also by asking questions like the one I just asked and asking them in his practice on the front lines to patients who have health issues and, you know, money issues too. And what if the easiest way to lessen the burden of poverty, both on individual patients and on our medical system as a whole, is to just give people enough money that they can live healthy lives? Why does the question sound crazy when I say it like that? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dr. Gary Block is a family physician at St. Michael's Hospital. He is also an associate professor at the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine. I wanted to ask you because I'm fascinated with the way you approach your frontline work. First of all, the basic question, tell me about the link between poverty and health.
The link between poverty and health is maybe the most studied, what we call an epidemiological link, so a link between a health risk and actual health outcomes that exists out there in the healthcare world. It's something that was talked about first, I mean, as far back as like the times of Aristotle, thousands of years ago. It was talked about very intensely for the last 150 years, believe it or not, in the medical world. And over the last decades, there's just been a slew of studies that have all shown the same thing, which is that living in poverty, living at low income is associated with worse health outcomes, higher rates of death for just about every illness, chronic illness, acute illness, accidents, trauma you can imagine. Huge impact on kids growing up in poverty. Mm-hmm. This gets a lot of press, although it's not the only impact of poverty. And it's been looked at, you know, everywhere from the level of sort of populations and how well populations do from a health perspective, but right down to the level of the way our genes, like deep inside our cells, express themselves and how that can change when we're living in poverty or growing up in poverty.
What does that look like? I mean, not on a cellular level, but what does that look like in someone's day-to-day life?
This is the world that I work in every day, right? So I'm a family doctor. I work in the front lines of medicine. I see people who live in poverty and live with actually all types of what I would call social risks to their health, right? So a lack of adequate housing, it may be the fact that they're racialized, maybe the fact that they don't have as much education as someone else. The way this plays out in my office is that they tend to develop illness earlier and to a more severe degree than what I see in people who are of higher socioeconomic status. People who develop diabetes, for instance, in their 20s and 30s as opposed to their 40s, 50s, or 60s. People who develop heart disease in their 40s instead of their 60s, right? Or have heart attacks at that point. Kids who are having difficulty in school and having behavior troubles. This comes into my office and this plays out. And this is not an inherent problem with them, but it's a sign of living with the chronic stress of a family that is dealing with not having enough basic resources to survive. So it really comes at my patients from every angle you could possibly imagine. It's quite astounding. I mean, I often feel like I'm spending my time literally just reaching out and putting out fires.
Do you explain that relationship to your patients?
I do. I mean, it's interesting, right? My patients know this, right?
Yeah.
This is not a surprise to someone who is living at an inadequate income,
right?
I mean, they know that that's impacting their health, right? They know that...
Do they know about the 150 years of data that proves this and the scope and... Like, I'm not saying that they have to know the scientific studies, but...
I mean, some do. So, I mean, they know the lives that they lead,
yes,
right? And it's very clear to them that they have and will have a very hard time protecting and maintaining their health if they just don't have the basic social foundations to do that. I might tell them to go out there and eat certain types of food or do certain levels of exercise or take certain medications or try and live stress-free, right? And they'll look at me like I'm crazy, right? I mean, they won't usually, but they'll often go off and not be able to do any of that and come back and their health has worsened. And, you know, I have learned over time to sort of dig down below that, right, and start asking people, tell me actually what's going on in your lives, right? It's not necessarily evident that someone is living in poverty or with other social threats to their health, but people are often very willing to tell you about what in their life is impacting their health.
So what happens when you take that step?
What happens is I hear stories, right? And I hear the really deep and difficult stories of people's lives, the challenges they face throughout their lives. And everyone's different, as we know. I mean, every person's an individual, and I have to take the time to hear those stories. And sometimes they go back to a childhood living with social adversity or a childhood where they may have faced trauma, for instance, that they were never had the space or the resources to adequately address, if that would have been possible. And sometimes it goes back a couple of years where they were doing okay, something happened, they lost their job and fell into poverty, and sometimes then just spiraled out and literally spiraled to the margins of society. But there's no assumptions I can make, right, yeah, when someone walks into my office at all. And I've learned this over and over again. I mean, I work in homeless shelters every week. And I often have sort of an hour to hear people's stories in the shelters. And mm-hmm. every single person's story is different. And even after doing this for 15 years, the number of times I am shocked and surprised by the stories that come through my doors is astounding.
So if sort of the typical eat better, get more exercise, lose the stress advice that we'd all get from our doctors isn't working, what can you offer them? What can you give them?
I mean, I certainly don't advocate that we stop doing all of
that.
Yeah,
of course.
Right. I mean,
but if those things are unfeasible for
absolutely.
People living on the margins sometimes.
Right. So along with the rest of my job, I mean, what I suggest is that we've got to stop burying our heads in the sand as health providers around the fact that we have to start addressing these social risks to people's health. We really want their health to get better, right? And I often talk about it as looking at people and saying, do you have the basic foundation in place to live a healthy life, right? And that basic foundation is all those things I've talked about. It's, do you have enough income to live, you know, to buy a decent diet, to pay your rent, mm-hmm. also to go out and live a somewhat stress-reduced life and have a little bit of a social life, et cetera? Do you have housing that you can rely on, right? Do you have a social support network that you can turn to? All of these pieces play into this idea of what that basic social foundation for health is, right? So what I say is that if someone doesn't have that in place, we as health providers need to start to build it with people, right? And that's actually the work that I've been doing over the last decade or more, is trying to figure out what can we do on the front lines of health to support our patients to build up that social foundation.
How do you do that?
So in many different ways, I can tell you. You know, the very first thing, which I actually think is really foundational, is that piece we talked about of just being willing to listen to and hear people's stories mm-hmm. and understand what an individual's social situation is and sort of make an individualized plan. But, you know, from there are very tangible things we can do to, for instance, increase someone's income. As a really basic example, one of the things that I advocate we as frontline doctors do is get people to file their taxes. Hmm. Right? It sounds ludicrous that you would walk into your doctor's office, right? And I would say, have you filled in and mailed in your income tax forms? Right? But for someone who's living at low income, many people have not bothered to fill in their income tax forms. They say, well, I'm not going to pay income taxes anyways. What's the point? But that is actually the entryway to a whole bunch of income benefits programs that exist in our society. And if you haven't filled out your taxes, you just don't get them.
Right.
Right. And I've seen situations where people more than double their income just by filling in an income tax form. Hmm. Right. I mean, I often tell the story of like a young single mother that I saw a few years ago with two young children, struggling, substandard housing. She was earning like $14,000 a year, right? Doing basically precarious minimum wage work. Hadn't filled out her income tax forms. And so I suggested she do this and she went and did it. And when she got her tax return back, it turned out she qualified for like $18,000 in tax-based benefits. I mean, that like literally brought her family pretty much to the poverty line, just like that, right? One simple intervention. And I mean, that in that one fell swoop, I mean, that absolutely had a bigger impact on her health and the health of her kids than almost anything else I could have imagined doing.
Yeah.
Right? So forget the drugs, forget dealing with her depression and, you know, the arthritis in her hands, et cetera, et cetera. It was really about the income in that case. And then that led to better housing and better childcare and et cetera, et cetera. And along those lines, I mean, connecting someone with a disability to disability support programs, for instance. I mean, right. You know, our basic welfare program in this province pays around $700 a month. Disability support's like $1,100 a month. It's not nearly enough money to survive in either case, but it is way, way more money than basic welfare, right? To be on disability supports, not to mention you get a certain security from that. So it's these types of very simple interventions that I've actually been involved in pushing out to the healthcare world for the last quite a few years now.
That was going to be my next question is, how do you scale those little minute interactions between a doctor and patient? Because like you said, there's a level of storytelling and trust and that kind of stuff that goes into it. How do you make that happen elsewhere?
I mean, it's an interesting question. So, I mean, there's many sides to that, right?
Yeah.
Part of it is just pure education. So, I mean, I've spoken with thousands of doctors over the years and talked about this. Really good reception pretty much across the board. But also getting like some of the big healthcare organizations to pick up on this message and starting to get them to talk about it as if this is a normal part of what we should be doing. Mm. So we've seen organizations like the Canadian Medical Association, the Canadian College of Family Physicians, Ontario College of Family Physicians, put out reports, put out frontline tools for health providers that guide them towards this type of intervention, and also say that this is really part of what we should be doing, right? We've also done a whole bunch of work just building this into like medical school curricula. Right. So like we now train medical students to do this stuff. And it's done a number of times now through medical schools, certainly at U of T and a number of other schools around the country now. Again, like looking to make this normal practice.
Tell me on that vein, tell me about the clinical tool on poverty.
So the clinical tool on poverty was sort of the first kind of, I often call it sort of the leading edge of the wedge of getting this message out to the healthcare world, right? So it was something I developed, I mean, very quickly off the side of my desk to support educational work I was doing, but then it kind of built a life of its own. I mean, all
Describe
it is.
Describe it for me.
Yeah, so all it is a 3-page handout that offers a simple 3-step approach to dealing with a social issue like poverty in a typical like frontline family medicine kind of appointment, right? So all it says is the first step is ask all of your patients about their income. The second step is remember that evidence linking poverty and poor health outcomes and just factor that into your thinking about patients. And the third step is, you know, remember a few simple questions to help connect your patients to income security benefits, right? The first question is that one I talked about, like, have you filled out your income tax forms? And then it kind of targets questions at kids and people with disabilities and seniors, et cetera, depending on where, you know, what particular demographic group someone comes from. What this did was it kind of reframed what is seen as a social issue or a moral issue. It reframed it as a medical issue. Right. And it said that I'm going to give you something that the kind of tool you receive for diabetes or heart disease or lung disease, but this one's about poverty.
Yeah.
Right. And here is a simple approach to dealing with this issue that you all know is a problem, but you've always said, I get that it affects my patient's health. I don't know what to do about it. And quite honestly, it's not my problem. Right. Mm. So this is making it your problem. And it's saying you can actually do something about it. I didn't know it would take off in the way it did, but that tool ended up being, again, picked up by the big organizations, but also replicated across the country, even replicated internationally. Like, it's quite amazing what kind of appetite there's been for this type of approach within the healthcare community.
If there is that appetite and the evidence is so conclusive that poverty and well-being are linked, every other health problem that we've known about for 150 years, we've worked at scale levels to solve, but not this one. Why? I know that's the million-dollar question, but you're here, so I might as well ask it.
It is the million-dollar question. I think there's a number of pieces to this, right? So medicine is always trying to figure out what it's about, right? So we've been on a huge push around medical technology. Fair enough, right? We built our MRIs. We built our laser machines, et cetera, et cetera. Huge push around drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And there's also fair enough, right? So for the last 70, 80 years, massive explosion in the kind of drugs that we've seen, and many of them are very useful and very effective. it's never really picked up on its social mandate in this way. And I could, I mean, I can only speculate as to why that is.
Of course, yeah.
I'd say, for one thing, many physicians have been hesitant to kind of to get involved in the social policy realm in this area. And so I think that although they have a strong history of social policy involved in other areas, right? Like you think of smoking, for instance.
Right.
I mean, huge decades-long story of advocacy. So it's not like it's so far out of our realm. You know, to get a little more controversial on this, but what I think is true is that, you know, physicians tend not to be a group that lives in poverty. So this issue may not hit as as close to home as some other issues might, or they may not have their kind of immediate family talking about it in the same way. Although, again, not entirely true. I mean, we all know people who live in poverty. We all deal with patients every day who live in poverty, right? So, I mean, I couldn't completely make that argument. We've also been living through, over the last 40 years especially, a general political environment that's been pretty averse to interventions that reduce social inequality in our society. And so, you know, this is completely beyond just the medical world, but there's been a sort of really big push away from the kind of social policy changes that would actually improve health on this front. And physicians, to be fair, are not social policy experts by training, right? Some of them absolutely become that, but probably get overwhelmed with the idea of coming in with and trying to shift where society is going politically overall. So there's many pieces there. But again, like I can tell you the appetite is there for this within the physician and the broader health provider world. It's a matter of finding ways to bring this health piece into that conversation.
So tell me about that work then on a larger level than the front lines, on the policy side of things.
So, I mean, I've been involved in social policy commentary and policy work for as long as I've been in medicine. In fact, you know, before my days in medicine, if you ask me where the real answers to the health risks of poverty and other social ills come from, it's going to come in social policy change. Yeah. And I've recognized that for a long time. And I've come at it from many angles, right? I mean, I'd say when I first started into this, it was much more from the kind of outsider activist angle. You know, when I first emerged into my career, I got very involved in a campaign around raising social assistance rates, for instance, associated with groups like the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, amongst others. And I guess what I started to see in that was there was a real interest in a health voice in that type of work, right? This is a very different voice than what you might call sort of the typical activists might have, right? I mean, we were talking about this. We weren't just yelling about this as saying, this is the way society should be. We were saying, if you don't change your social policy, people are going to suffer, and we are seeing them suffer, right? And that becomes a very real, tangible thing.
What kinds of policies can actually come out of that, though?
So there are a lot of very real things that can be done to improve our income security system, for instance, in this country. And there are many angles you can take on that. I mean, if you just take social assistance as one, it's actually just a small piece of our income security system. But if you just take that, I mean, so you can pick out certain pieces, right? One obvious piece is that we just don't give people enough money to be healthy. So until you raise social assistance rates themselves, people will actually find that their health worsens and worsens dramatically living on social assistance. That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Because we think we're saving money by not giving them as much. We're going to end up paying it out of the health system. So that's one piece of it. But then you can also build a whole bunch of supports around people, right? If you can reorient that system to helping people to work their way out of poverty, to dealing with their barriers for getting out of poverty, you could have a very different looking system, one that was really geared towards the needs of individuals, right? So someone, again, who maybe have some level of disability, a substance use issue, who may also not have a very high level of education, who may also face systemic barriers, right? Like they're a person of color and has having difficulty entering the job market because of this. You can have very specific programs targeted at accommodating their disabilities, working to improve their education, connecting them with health providers to improve their overall health status, working with employers around anti-racism policies, for instance. And suddenly you have this like multimodal approach to improving someone's social health, which comes right out of our social support and social assistance system, right? That is absolutely doable within the system that we have. Right. And I say that as someone who sat on a commission for the government of Ontario that laid out a plan for redesigning our income security system. We costed it. We had a timeline. It was a 10-year timeline to it. And I can tell you, by the end of that process, the minister was behind us. The bureaucracy was behind us. I mean, it was imminently doable. In fact, we were on the verge of seeing it realized.
And then an election happened.
An election happened and the social policy environment or the political environment changed a little.
Yeah, well, that's my kind of the last piece of this is we talk a lot on this program, and I think people in news everywhere talk about income inequality and the unchecked growth of it.
Yeah.
Is there an appetite among the average voter out there to do something about this? And if there's not enough of a will out there, how can you change minds on this when it seems so simple when you lay it out like that?
You know, I think there's a couple of pieces to this, right? So one issue our government faces is that it's still very siloed, right? So, I mean, and we see this playing out right now, right? That we have a government that's saying we are going to reduce spending in each of our different ministries in each of our different areas, right? So social assistance feels pressure to reduce spending, so does health, right? The challenge is that you reduce spending in social assistance, you need to increase spending in health because people get poorer,
right.
They end up less healthy, they draw from the health system, right? So if you can start to reduce those silos, start to create a kind of whole of government cross-ministerial perspective on this, it actually will become fairly obvious, I think, that it is worth spending money to reduce inequality and to reduce the level of poverty and the number of people who live on the social margins, because it will save money in other areas, right? It's smart fiscal policy. It's smart health policy. But it does require a different view of what government does. I mean, the World Health Organization advocates something called health in all policies as an approach, which basically says, you know, whatever policy you're putting forward, think about the health implications, right? So think broadly. There are countries that have implemented this approach, right? I mean, it is, again, entirely possible and entirely doable. What will get us there? I mean, that's the hard thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I am a big believer in the power of narrative and the power of stories. And I do think that a lot of the time, people who live on the social margins are invisible to the kind of, you know, average person in our society. One huge step forward just to be to start telling those stories, right? Start talking about the reality of living with social pressures on you from a number of different angles. And also talk about how society worsens that situation and small things that may help people get out of that. And those stories may start making this more of a human issue as well, which I think has been one of the really big challenges around pushing this idea of a real health-oriented social policy change.
I think you might have answered this near the very beginning, but my last question to you is if there was one piece of practical advice for people who struggle with their income that they could do if they were a patient in your office, is it just make sure you do your taxes?
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah.
As a first step. I mean, and then it's, you know, start getting connected with the kind of expert community support agencies that are out there.
I think a lot of people feel lost trying to do that,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah, they do. I mean, there's a great service in Ontario called 211, which you can call phone number 211, look on the internet, 211ontario.ca. It'll list for you every community support agency that is out there.
Does that exist in other provinces in Canada?
It exists not in every province, but many other provinces. I think 7 provinces have it now. If nothing else, go look on 211, start to find those connections, find who's out there to help you, and get a family doctor. And ideally someone who is willing to sit there and listen to your story and work with you around it from a true holistic health perspective.
Thanks, Gary.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gary Block, family physician at St. Michael's, associate professor at the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine. And that was The Big Story. You can find more big stories at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find more podcasts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can find more annoying posts by me on social media at TheBigStoryFPN or follow me at The Game Sheet. You can also follow our whole network at Frequency Pods on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And you can find us wherever you get podcasts. You know it by now. It's Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and Radio Public. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.